Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, August 1st, 2014. The ceasefire lasted, about 20 minutes in Gaza this morning. Maybe we need to send Shakira there.
Ladies up in here tonight. No fighting.
We got the refugees.
No fighting.
The Wyclef Jean can announce.
No fighting.
No fighting.
Shakira, Shakira.
I never really knew that she could dance like this.
Hey.
She make a man want to speak Spanish. Como se llama?
Hey.
Shakira. Oh, baby, when you talk,
I want to dedicate today's News and Comment podcast to the late Rick Klein, my friend who passed away on the 3rd of June. And my podcast will be a little shorter today because I'm on a tight schedule as I head out to his memorial service this afternoon. And death continues to rain down in Gaza. Late yesterday, after I filed my daily report, there was the announcement of a 72-hour peace ceasefire, and when it went into effect early morning time in the Middle East, it didn't last very long. Now, once again, we have conflicting finger-pointing. The dominant narrative, which comes from Israel and has been embraced by the American White House, is that Hamas militants, after the ceasefire went into effect, surfaced from a tunnel along the Rafah border with Egypt. Now, again, the conflicting reports are that the spokesman for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, said that government forces had been moving to destroy a tunnel when several militants came out of the ground. Now, this underscores that this ceasefire was not a complete ceasefire. The language that Israel had agreed to was, well, we'll stop the bombing, we'll stop shelling, but we assert the right to continue to blow up tunnels. And the Rafah border has always had tunnels. Egypt has moved to shut many of those down with the change of guard in the past year. And so what we are told occurred is that Israel moved to destroy a tunnel, and then militants surfaced, including what is described as one suicide attacker. So, if Israel was flushing out a tunnel and Hamas fighters surfaced, can you then blame Hamas for breaking this ceasefire? Well, that's how it is playing out. What is interesting is, in the same skirmish, it is reported, and there are conflicting reports at this hour, it's 12:30 Pacific time on this Friday. The conflicting reports are whether or not a young lieutenant of the Israeli army was taken captive. Now, after the initial publication of that news, the military censor in Israel notified the New York Times that further information related to the soldier would have to be submitted for prior review. They note, journalists for foreign news organizations must agree in writing to the military censorship system in order to work in Israel. This is the first censorship notification the Times has received in more than 2 years. Now, my roguish comment here is that the American media has been self-censoring, and the Israelis haven't needed to invoke their censorship rules for the past 2 years. And once again, predictably, on script, Bibi Netanyahu, quote, the Palestinians have blatantly and unilaterally violated the humanitarian ceasefire and attacked our soldiers. Hamas and the other terrorist organizations in Gaza would bear the consequences of their acts. Well, as I said, it's not clear who started this. It's not clear who violated the ceasefire. But time and again, we get the 1,000% certainty that comes from Benjamin Netanyahu. And I, for one, don't believe him. Death toll climbs now past 1,400 for the Palestinians, 66 on the Israeli side. And today I conducted a lengthy, in-depth interview, an hour conversation with Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. He's got a great new book out that is about the Arab Spring and what has happened since. It's called The New Arabs. I recommend it to you, and I also recommend our hour-long in-depth interview. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And here's an excerpt from that conversation where Professor Cole talks about the current conflict between Israel and Hamas.
The current government in Israel, which is a coalition of very far right-wing parties, I mean, they're so far right that were they to control a government in Europe, it would be boycotted. That government, led by the Likud party, but with coalition partners actually to its right, was never interested in an actual peace settlement with Palestinians. They want Palestinian land and resources, and they want to subordinate the Palestinians and make them docile. Kind of, you know, I compare it to the apartheid South Africa government's use of Bantustans to isolate and denaturalize the black African population in South Africa. So that's what they want, is Bantustans. And I think, frankly, that Secretary of State John Kerry was irresponsible in trying to launch these peace negotiations last August, because it was foreseeable that the Israeli side would sabotage them, which it very concertedly did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost as soon as they agreed to the talks, there were cabinet members who called some of the steps leading to the negotiations, such as the release of some PLO prisoners, the equivalent of the Holocaust, who attempted to undermine Prime Minister Netanyahu. And then they, as you said, they kept announcing more and more Israeli housing units on Palestinian territory in the West Bank. And last winter, one of the cabinet members complained about John Kerry, said he's trying for a Nobel Prize, that he's obsessed with this issue of the peace process and has messianic kind of delusions of grandeur. This is not the kind of talk you would want to hear from a partner in a peace process.
As I mentioned, you can hear the full interview with Professor Juan Cole. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. Now, here's a story I have been waiting for. And I want to give a big shout-out to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! I don't get to listen or watch the program very often. I just don't really have the time to devote to it. But I give Democracy Now! A lot of credit. And I want to also give a shout-out to our listener and subscriber, Joe Clarici, because it was his Facebook post of this segment of Democracy Now! That brought it to my attention. You may have heard me in increasing volume challenging the assertions that come from the Israeli propaganda machine that the Iron Dome missile defense system has been performing with an accuracy of 90%. And I have called bullshit on this. I don't believe that missile defense actually works. It's mostly psychological warfare, psychological spin. It is a myth. And so Amy Goodman interviewed MIT's physicist Theodore Postol. And I've talked with Ted Postol before because he was the courageous person who surfaced the skepticism about the claims of the effectiveness of Patriot missiles by the U.S. in our conflict with Saddam Hussein over Kuwait back in 1992. And Ted Postol says that maybe 5%, maybe 10% of the Iron Dome intercepts are actually knocking out the rockets that are being sent by Hamas. And I'll put up a link to the interview at Democracy Now! So you can read it for yourself. But he talks about the different prospects of whether you intercept it head on, whether you hit the incoming rocket from the side, or whether you chase it from behind and catch up with it and at that point blow it up. And he said in each case, the probability is very low that you can even actually make contact. But even if you do make contact with this incoming rocket, you don't disable its warhead. Now, it might explode in the sky, but it also could bring the rocket down and cause it to explode at whatever location that is. And as I talked with reporter Joe Lauria, who was in the West Bank the other day, that's in our Processing Distortion interview over at BoilingFrogsPost.com. Well, he said he's heard unconfirmed reports that Israel sends up the Iron Dome and then it self-detonates in the sky to create the perception, the phony perception, that it has actually taken out a Hamas rocket. The other interesting takeaway from the interview with Professor Postol is that Raytheon is the American contractor that stands to benefit most from the hundreds of millions of dollars, $225 million, authorized by the Congress as emergency funding for Israel. Now, late yesterday, I released for subscribers a great interview with our friend and colleague, investigative reporter Jason Leopold. And this occurred right after the news broke that John Brennan, CIA director, had finally apologized to the Senate Intelligence Committee and its top dogs, Dianne Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss. And what he acknowledged is that he was wrong, and that contrary to his assertions back in March, that his underlings had, in fact, inappropriately accessed the hard drives and computers of Senate staff members who were investigating the CIA for the torture report that is still being withheld. And just after that news broke, we caught up with Jason, and he shared this comment with us about the charges that Senate Intelligence Chair Dianne Feinstein leveled at the CIA back in March, charges that still could be prosecuted.
Dianne Feinstein, who is the chairwoman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, who is the woman who made, the senator who made the delivered this extraordinary floor statement, 45-minute floor statement back in March, in which she accused the CIA of spying. And at the time, she said that, did the CIA search of Senate computers violate the Fourth Amendment, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and Executive Order 12333, which prohibits the CIA from conducting domestic searches or surveillance. And the Inspector General, in the unclassified summary of the report I obtained, says that potential violations here are violation of the Wiretap Act and Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. So a couple things. One, it's ironic that Dianne Feinstein is talking about Executive Order 12333, which is what all intelligence agencies use to collect foreign intelligence and or communications, including Americans, and it's been exploited. And yet she doesn't want to do anything about that or look into that. But obviously very concerned because it pertains to her oversight duties. So that's when she's screaming about it. And the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That's really interesting, and it'll be interesting if anyone is actually found guilty of that, or if someone has actually violated that law, because that's the same one that's been used to essentially prosecute all these hackers.
You can hear that full interview with Jason Leopold. It's available now for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And following on that news, in Friday's New York Times, the lead editorial slams the CIA for what it calls a reckless breach of trust. But it comes up short about what should be done about it. It draws a quote from Lindsey Graham, senator from South Carolina, in saying heads should roll and people should go to jail. Well, good for you, Lindsey. That's a rare call for accountability on your part, particularly in the intelligence community. But tagging on to Graham's comment that people should go to jail or heads should roll, the Times editorial continues, one of those heads may need to be Mr. Brennan's. Why are they equivocating? Mark Udall of Colorado, the senator, has called for his resignation, and the Times should be echoing that. This kind of maybe his head needs to roll? Come on. That's insulting. It truly is. Well, I want to thank the people who support my work here at peterbcollins.com with your subscriptions. People like Chris Welsh, Gary Washington, Lightworks Art, and we mentioned Rita Sheldrake the other day, but she deserves an extra shout out. So thanks to each and every one of you. Want to invite those who don't currently subscribe to come on over, peterbcollins.com. Do you know the drill? You look for my picture on the homepage. It's not hard to find. Under it, there's a link that says sign up. Click on that, takes you to a page. You choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD with political overtones called Red Flag. Well, at this hour, the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives is still in disarray. Yesterday, deeply embarrassing their leader, Speaker John Boehner, he had to pull a bill that he thought he had the votes to pass, related to a scaled-back appropriation for the crisis of young refugees at the border. And it's, about 20% of what Obama asked for. And even that couldn't get through with the Tea Party radicals who continue to really create problems for Mr. Boehner. And so at this hour, again, noon hour Pacific time here on Friday, we don't have news of any votes that have taken place. There was a closed-door emergency meeting this morning of the Republican caucus, and House Republicans leaving the meeting expected to hold votes on two border security measures later in the afternoon. We'll see if they're actually able to achieve that. And, of course, most of this is dead on arrival in the Senate, and a lot of it doesn't matter because both houses are going on vacation, leaving so much business unaddressed. It's really shocking. It is a new low in American government. Eric Holder, the embattled attorney general in whom I have very little confidence, has nevertheless been advancing some good policy positions lately. The sentencing reform for drug offenders. And last night he appeared on the PBS NewsHour for a series of softball questions from anchor Gwen Ifill. And even as I acknowledge that he is, at this point, promoting some decent policies to remove racial disparity in sentences and reform other issues, he was asked about the current status of capital punishment in this country, and he noted that he's personally opposed to it, but he exercises his duty as Attorney General. And he raised questions. He said, for the state to exercise the greatest of all powers, to end a human life, it seems to me, just on a personal level, that transparency would be a good thing, and to share the information about what chemicals are being used, what drugs are being used. Well, that sounds good in that context, right? But even as he attempts to advance a reasonable policy position, he exposes his own hypocrisy, because it's his department that wrote the memo that we're told justifies the execution of Anwar al-Awlaki. It was conducted by a chemical cocktail called an unmanned aerial drone. It was done without any trial, without any charges, without any finding that Anwar al-Awlaki should be put to death. And Eric Holder's fingerprints are on the memo that supports that decision. And that's just one example of the rank hypocrisy that he often displays. In Florida, a courageous judge, Terry P. Lewis of the Second Judicial Circuit, ordered state lawmakers to revise the congressional map for the Sunshine State because he said the other one was, in my words, hopelessly gerrymandered. What he did say, and this is a quote, is that the map drawn by Republicans for Republicans, quote, made a mockery of a voter-approved anti-gerrymandering amendment to the state constitution meant to inject fairness into a process that has long been politically tainted. And if you look at the congressional map for Florida, it's a joke. I mean, some of the doodles that they use to draw district lines for Congress are really indefensible, and they're all based on the advanced mapping processes that are available now that allow the people who are in elected office to choose their voters instead of the other way around. And finally, today here in California, in the Bay Area, we have a number of bridges that get people over the bay. One of them runs from Oakland to San Francisco, and it's called the Bay Bridge. It was rebuilt over the last 10 years following the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake that severely damaged the eastern span. The original price tag was $1.5 billion. When it was completed last year and opened, this defective work of public construction came in at $6.5 billion, and we know that it has many defects. The steel that came from China has bad welds. The bolts that were made in the United States but delivered to the Oakland construction site were stored outside, and they developed rust problems that caused them to break. And these are huge bolts, you know, like 20, 30 feet long and 6 or 8 inches in diameter. Well, to its credit, the San Francisco Chronicle and its ace reporter Jackson Van Derbeken are exposing the way the California Department of Transportation, Caltrans, which ran the construction project, repeatedly muzzled and transferred and fired or didn't renew contracts for engineers who piped up and said, "Hey, you're installing defective parts on this bridge. You've got bad steel going in there. We ought to stop this and fix it." And so what we're seeing is there was an ongoing and massive cover-up of the clear defects that occurred and that were known to the engineering staff and to high-ranking Caltrans officials, even as they continued to push construction and completion of this defective project. Governor Jerry Brown, who does some good things, he just came back from a trip to Mexico, and he needs to fire the head of Caltrans, and he needs to fire the head of the Public Utilities Commission. Both of them have proven that they don't deserve to hold those jobs, and they don't have public trust. Thanks for listening today. You are free to share this podcast with absolutely anyone. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.